my name is Ariel Ennis, and I am with the Office of Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful. In this week's podcast, we are going to bring in the world-renowned Sharon Salzberg, one of the most important mindfulness and meditation teachers in the United States. We're going to talk a little bit about how she got involved in mindfulness and meditation and some of her early teaching experiences, and then talk about how these tools might be useful in our current moment of increased polarization, divisiveness, and I think a general level of anxiety. So thanks for listening to Multifaithful, and now to this week's conversation. I am joined today by the famous Sharon Salzberg. Sharon, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you.
So I usually introduce people with a more formal and title introduction, but you are doing so many different things, I thought that that is impossible. So if you could maybe just start by telling listeners who aren't as familiar with your work, like, what do you do?
What do I do? Gosh. Yeah. Well, I guess the basic thing I do is teach meditation. And I've been doing that for a very long time, like over 40 years. Mm-hmm. I'm the co-founder of a retreat center in Massachusetts called the Insight Meditation Society. And I've written, I believe at this point, it's 9 books. I have one more coming out in June.
So that's
number 10.
And if I'm correct, a few of them have made it pretty high up the New York Times bestseller list.
One was on the New York Times bestseller list, yeah. So I said to my publisher, well, you know, it wasn't on that long. And they said, no.
It's on.
For the rest of your life, you are a New York Times bestselling author. So
maybe that's how I should have introduced you then.
Right.
And so you are, I think, pretty well known, especially in the mindfulness meditation world, as someone who's done a lot of work on bringing mindfulness from, you know, Eastern religions or from, and bringing it to the United States, especially to the West, and for people who maybe had no exposure, to help introduce them to some of this. So I thought maybe we'd start, you could just tell us a little bit about sort of those early years, that early journey, why you thought it was important to bring mindfulness and meditation to the United States, and like how you yourself got interested.
I think, in all honesty, it was kind of less purposeful than that, less envisioned, you know, or strategic. I went to India for my own study and practice. I went as part of a university program. It was sort of like my junior year abroad. And I, like many people, stayed longer than that 1 year wherever we ended up. And I did come back. I finished school. I went back to India again. So in 1974, I was getting ready to leave for what I thought was a very short trip back to the U.S. And I went to see one of my teachers, who was a woman named Deepa Ma, or Deepa's mother is her nickname, Deepa Ma, and just to get her blessing for my very short trip back. And she said, oh, you're going to be teaching when you go back. And I said, no, I won't. And she said, yes, you will. And I said, no, I won't. And we went through a whole thing about that. But I came back, and Joseph Goldstein, whom I had met in India, had already come back. He was teaching in Boulder, Colorado, the first summer of Naropa Institute. It was just opening up. And I went and joined him there, and then we got an invitation to lead a retreat, and then another, you know, so it just, it all cascaded. And, you know, the techniques, the methods of meditation, both mindfulness and loving kindness or compassion, had been extremely important for me personally. I never really thought about teaching it or bringing it back, but it had been so important for each of us that it just seemed like a natural thing to do, to respond to the requests. And I sort of had that lineage blessing from my own teacher, you know, so I didn't feel like I was just setting out a shingle, you know, and saying, I'm a teacher, you know. And it just kind of grew from there, and then more recently actually kind of exploded from there.
Yeah, well, I mean, especially here at NYU and just college students, the, you know, using meditation and mindfulness has completely exploded.
It's fabulous.
So I'm curious, I am someone who came to this job having absolutely zero background in mindfulness and meditation. And my role within our center here is not the mindfulness and meditation stuff. I do mostly interfaith. I have learned a ton about mindfulness and meditation working here, and it's sort of been a process of exposure, you know, over the last 3 years, like getting more and more. For people who don't really understand mindfulness or meditation, why is it, why has it been exploding? Like, can you tell, why are people finding it so important? Because it's exploding for a reason. And I think you can look at a lot of good research and just anecdotal evidence that it's not a passing fad. Like, people are really using this in different fields in really interesting ways now. So why did that happen?
Well, I think part of the explosion is because of the research, was because in the beginning, neuroscientists, and now maybe a broader range of scientists have gotten interested in, how does this work? Does it work?
Right.
It's almost like the language, the idiom of our time and our place is science. And so once there was some sense of scientific interest and perhaps backing of the methods, then it was very exciting. There was a language in which to present it. And, you know, I think the one of the basic principles of something like mindfulness meditation is that it doesn't have to be tied to a belief system. Right. It's really not about any kind of orthodoxy of, you know, doctrine. Or I learned it certainly within a Buddhist tradition. And the first night, this is in India, my first meditation retreat, the teacher said, the Buddha did not teach Buddhism. He taught a way of life. This has nothing to do with Buddhism. So that was like my beginning, you know, that was my introduction. And I've always held it in that way. So all kinds of people, and everyone's welcome to explore the methodology. And it is powerful methodology.
Yeah.
It's also simple. You know, it's deceptively simple sounding.
Yes. What I often find is that when people talk about mindfulness, I understand everything they're saying, and I understand all the words, sort of like in a very heady way, but I have trouble really like grasping why it's so different. But I also see people out there in like the media or public intellectuals who are completely skeptical and like bash religion at any time that they can find, who like are really invested in increasing the use of mindfulness. It's like found this interesting niche, even for people who really don't like religion.
Yeah. Well, it's very experiential.
Yeah.
I mean, for some people, religion is also experiential, though not for everybody. You know, for some people, it really is. I mean, I read a book called Faith. And I ran into it quite a lot, you know. In a way, I almost felt like one of my goals, even though I hadn't realized it in writing the book, was to reclaim the word. Because the use of it had gotten so distorted in people's real experience, not just in their minds, you know, not being able to ask questions, feeling rejected if they had doubt, you know, things like that. And so I think it's a similar kind of thing, you know, if somebody is really wanting a lived spirituality and something that is integrated into their life, not something that's held on a certain day of the week and has nothing to do with, you know, Tuesday, or their relationship, you know, then something very practical, you know, that one actually does. Or put it another way, I have a friend who's British. He grew up in the Church of England, and he said from the time that he was maybe 9 years old, he used to hear "Love thy neighbor as thyself," and he said his whole body, it would be like this thrill would go through his whole body. He just felt exalted. And then he got into big trouble because his next question was always, well, how?
Right.
You know, what if you don't like your neighbor? What if you don't like yourself? What if you're afraid of your neighbor? What if you're chronically afraid anyway? You know, like, how do you deal with the things of the mind that come up as obstructions to our deepest ideals? And that's where meditation lives.
Right.
You know, is in a very direct and practical way of dealing with your mind.
So I want to, you do a lot of metta meditation or loving kindness meditation. And so I was wondering if you could give listeners some insight into specifically that type of meditation. Like, what does that mean, and why is that different than a sort of maybe a different type of meditation?
Sure. Well, mindfulness meditation is really designed to help us see the difference between our actual experience and whatever we may be laying on top of that due to conditioning. Like, if you have, for example, an unpleasant feeling in your body, some kind of discomfort, many people have the habit of projecting that into the future, like, what's it going to feel like tomorrow? Right. What's it going to feel like next week? So we're not just experiencing the discomfort, we're experiencing that plus all the anticipation. So mindfulness helps us be aware enough to kind of slice right through that.
Right.
So we see, oh, this is what's happening, this is the extra stuff. We know how to let go gently of the extra stuff and return to our actual experience. So it helps bring us closer and closer to the truth. Loving kindness, or metta, M-E-T-T-A, in Pali, language of the original Buddhist text, works somewhat differently. It's, I call it a stretch. It's like realizing maybe that your mind, you're set in certain ruts, certain ways of seeing yourself mm-hmm. and others and life, and you stretch to look from a different angle. So, for example, if you are the kind of person who has the habit at the end of the day of looking back almost as though to evaluate yourself, mm-hmm. like, how did I do today? And if you're the kind of person who pretty well only remembers the things you did wrong and the mistakes you mm-hmm. made and, you know, how you messed up, let's just say, mm-hmm. The practice of loving kindness is to stretch. It's not to deny and say, you know, you're perfect. But what else happened today? You know, what's the good within you? You know, so we stretch. Or a very critical part of metta is, who do we pay attention to? Who do we not? How often do we walk into that store and look kind of right through the shopkeeper? Right. And so what happens if, through intentionality, we look at them instead of through them? Mm-hmm. You know, so metta is not about liking people. It's not about approving of people. It's not about taking them home for dinner. You know, it's,
right.
it's about affirming a sense of connection that actually is true. Mm-hmm. And the more we can modulate how we pay attention, the more that sense of connection will just emerge.
It strikes me as topical, like, or, you know, sort of very relevant to the present moment, which I guess makes a lot of sense for mindfulness, which is supposed to be attuned to the present moment. But it seems that in our particular moment, it's a skill that's particularly useful.
Yeah.
In a recent article you wrote, you used this phrase I thought was really interesting. You said you talked about how, especially in the wake of the election, you've seen like an addiction to outrage. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could expand on that a little, because that struck me as like very true. It struck me as something that possibly I've noticed in my own reaction to things. And I'm curious, one, how you would like describe what that means, and then two, and probably more importantly, like why that's maybe not a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've certainly seen it myself too, right. which is why, you know, why I feel comfortable saying it. I've seen several reactions, not amongst everybody, of course, because people have very different relationships to the election and what happened, mm-hmm. but in large numbers of people, I've seen a lot of despair, like really a sense of being crushed. And that's not that useful, obviously, you know, right. personally for oneself or for this world. And the other reaction is more like that kind of addiction to outrage, just like perpetually upset and, mm-hmm. you know, reading everything. And like, I have a friend who sends me,
I think I
like
have that
every compulsion. Link, you know. And yep. I was like, you know, I mean, sometimes I appreciate it because I would have missed something, but right. honestly, I could, you know.
Yeah. I think my wife has instituted a rule in our house of no listening to politics podcasts before bed.
That's right.
It was like, it was just getting too much.
Yeah. So there's a certain, in sort of the meditation world, there's a certain link that's often made where they say one of the roots of anger is a sense of helplessness. Hmm. When we feel weak, we pick up anger because we think it's going to make us strong. And there is a strength to it in right. the energy of it. But there's also, anger is likened to a forest fire, which can burn up its own support.
Right.
It damages us, you know, mm-hmm. and it doesn't give us the clarity of vision to see what our options might be for action. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you think about the last time you were really, really angry at yourself, mm-hmm. it's not a time where you thought, well, maybe I'll work it out this right. way, you know.
Probably didn't like, lead to immediately having like a moment of clarity, like, oh, that's what I have to do.
That's right. That's right. And we need that clarity. And we need resolve and we need energy. So what I've been telling people is that certainly despair is not that useful. But that's sort of a, you know, perpetual chronic mm-hmm. outrage is not that useful either because right. it's exhausting. And so I just say to people, see if you can find one thing mm-hmm. that you're passionate about and creating more good in this world. And, and put your energy there, you know. So I am trying not to – I have changed my media habits actually mm-hmm. hugely since the election. My thing, something I'm very, very passionate about that I think reflects completely my spiritual understanding is voting. I think everybody needs to vote. No one mm-hmm. who has the right to vote should ever be denied the right to vote. It has to do with my view of innate human dignity and having a voice and mm-hmm. everybody having worth. And on that level being equal. And I got into trouble. You know, I wrote, I think the first thing that happened was something about voting, really urging people to vote, went up on my Facebook page. And my assistant said to me, "Boy, you just lost a whole bunch of followers," you know? And
then, interesting.
And I don't tell people who to vote for. This is like totally just nonpartisan. Just about voting. Just vote, engage, you know? This is your right. This is important.
Right.
And then I wrote something. I think it was the Huffington Post asked me to write something, and I wrote something, and I did the thing that writers always tell you not to do, which is I read the comments, you know, which was like...
Yeah, it probably wasn't a good idea.
It wasn't a good idea. Like, I think so much less of you than I did before. Right. And I thought, really?
That's so interesting.
You know, and then I have it's now a monthly column at On Being, and I wrote a thing on voting, and I made the same mistake, and I read the comments, and I was like, whoa. But, I mean, it means something to me that this be a democracy, and that means people engaging. And so I'm just going to keep going, you know?
Yeah, so I'm curious. I feel like one of the areas that you'll get pushback on when you talk about sort of outrage as a concept is that people often find it's very hard to move the needle without something big. And I think the something big becomes outrage, even though it doesn't have to be outrage. So how can people be proactive and active and pick up a cause that they care about while doing it in a way that you think is probably more emotionally healthy and is better? Like, how do you balance those?
Yes, it's not easy. And in some way, that's why we need one another. We need people, other people with that sense of possibility. And I think almost always outrage is at the beginning, you know, it like wakes us up and so we say, oh my God, you know, like, look at that, this can't be. But the question is what happens when it becomes chronic, when it becomes an addiction. And I mean, true activist friends of mine say to me, it ends up being very destructive because people don't know how to turn it off. Then they turn on one another within the organization or there's just a kind of empty enmity, you know, that doesn't serve anybody because of that tunnel vision. And so, you know, we talk about balance all the time, balance between compassion for yourself and compassion for someone else. If you are highly engaged, then some kind of self-care. It's okay to breathe, you know, and like take a break or enjoy your children or, you know, many things people won't do, you know. And, you know, to understand, I mean, it's not easy for us. I think in general we're a very impatient culture. But we don't always see the results right away.
Right.
It's like you got to do the thing without that kind of attachment to the immediate result. Because if you don't do it, probably nothing will happen. But it may not happen in a week and a half either, you
probably
know?
Probably won't.
It probably won't.
Do you have any, like, examples you can point people to of sort of activism that's embodied with this? That's like done that's been a good job, because I think this is a conversation I've had with people, and I've had students sort of reflect back to me these words or concepts, but I find that the actual implementation or pointing to someone practically doing it is often where they get lost. I'm curious if you like actually know of examples to point to.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the clear example would be the civil rights movement in this country, not every facet of it, but, and I was a little young to be, not that young, but I was just a little too young. But even now, watching clips of like the Freedom Riders, you know, which was scary stuff. Yeah. And you know, I'd watch them like get down and pray and go forward and get beaten up. And this is all about the right to vote, right? So it's very close to my heart. And, you know, and then there was this shot, this video of this guy in the hospital all beaten up. And he was like radiant, you know, and he was telling this guy, well, we practice nonviolence, you know. And you just realize there's like a spiritual wealth inside there that is being cultivated through song, through prayer, through their community that allows people to do things like I don't think I could do, you know, that readily. And I certainly couldn't do without a practice.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know what form that looks like now exactly. And maybe we're just going to keep creating.
Well, that was going to be my next question. I feel like most of the activism either I do myself, which admittedly I'm not, I work in education, I'm not necessarily the world's biggest activist, but or that I'm involved in or try and support, you know, philanthropically. I feel like it doesn't have this part of the conversation, but it's not a conversation I hear a
lot. Yeah. And I think you will hear more and more.
Yeah.
Because the other part, I think everyone is an activist. So I don't think you need to be protesting. I'm really intrigued at what's going to happen now with artists and poets and musicians, you know, where there's a sense of another sense of like a counterculture that's needed, you know, aside from the prevalent thing one might be seeing on.
Do you think there'll be TV? You'll kind of get more of this from maybe not like strictly political activism, sort of more artistic expression?
Well, I think the spiritual side will be hopefully everywhere, but I think we also need to extend our definition of activism, because I think there will be many, many kinds of expression just depending on someone's own personality. But I do think there will be more and more because of that kind of unification of view. And it will take many forms.
Right.
But the sources of strength from that kind of, I hate to say it, but like spiritual power, you know, it's pretty strong.
Right.
And I think, and so many more people have a practice anyway.
Right.
You know, that, you know, I watch these YouTube things of people, meditation teachers going down to Zuccotti Park, you know, Occupy Wall Street, you know, and they're just teaching. And
right.
You know, isn't that interesting, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like we're, at least in the United States, because of sort of the nature of the civil rights movement, we're conditioned to not be surprised if, like, a church, a synagogue, a mosque, like, brings a group to a march. But if we saw someone leading a meditation at a rally, I think it would catch more people very off guard.
Well, I mean, there were a number of my friends got strongly involved in the fast food strikers movement, you know, striking for $15 minimum wage. And they used to hold sittings, you know, and they're really great newspaper shots, you know, these people sitting and... And they had T-shirts that said "Sit for 15," which was great. I mean, it's bringing worlds together, you know, which is another thing. Yeah. Like, it was not easy. You know, people would hear things like, I think so much less of you, but no, they would hear things like, I don't think there should be fast food restaurants, you know, which is another question. But, you know, people are... That's their livelihood. Mm-hmm. They're working more than 40 hours a week, and they're living in homeless shelters because they're not getting a living wage. And, you know, as long as there are those places, don't you want the, you know?
Right.
Or even there was this fabulous ad from this organization that is trying to establish rights for home health care workers and people like that. And there were all these older people in the ad saying, you know, do I really want to be taken care of from someone who's underpaid and hates their job?
Right.
Maybe not, you know? You know, and that kind of perspective, I think, can really, of, you know, respect for everybody and care for everybody, which is at the heart of spiritual traditions.
Right.
Can really spread.
That's interesting. So this our current moment feels, I think, different to a lot of people. And I think I'm on the sort of younger end. I mean, I have certain, like, watershed political moments already in my life. But this one definitely felt just different. I'm curious if you've seen similar times, like similar world events that have created sort of this feeling. Because it does feel, at least from my working with students, I think students feel just, it feels different now than after it does after a normal election. And we could debate the causes of that endlessly, but I think it's inescapable that there is a difference right now.
I think it's different. Although, you know, how much of that feeling is simply not remembering, but...
Right.
You know, I mean, I have, of course, lived through various, you know, presidencies, for example, or different situations, and but I do think it's different.
Yeah.
And so I think it, maybe calling for more depth from us, even than before. Right. But I also know, like I said this, I was teaching last night, like, you know, we look back at movements and, like, I could say, you know, I watched this movie about the Freedom Riders, mm-hmm. and I thought, how brave and how courageous to do what had to be done so that those changes could happen. And one day I just realized they didn't know it was going to work.
Right.
You know, they just did it because it was the right thing to do. Like, but we look back with the benefit of history in hindsight mm-hmm. to say, oh, it worked. And
yeah.
Yes, you know, I could do that if I knew it worked. It would work, you know, but it's not that easy.
No, you know, certainly not.
Not knowing, but that's the reality.
Right. Right. Is there anything else you want to discuss?
Voting. Everybody has voting. To vote.
Everyone has to vote. Well, thank you. This has been great. I think this has been... It's been a conversation that I've been having in my head a lot, so it's good to talk it out with someone who has great. A good handle on the mindfulness aspect and uh-huh. help talk through it. Uh-huh. But thank great. You so much for giving us so much time.
Thank you. Thank you for your work.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. Especially like to thank our guest, Sharon Salzberg, for spending so much time with me today and for just, I had a blast doing the podcast with her. So thanks for coming in. Special thank you to Brian Young, as always, for editing and producing the podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We look forward to having you back for another episode in 2 weeks.